What I found in Wick's letter.
Dear Rachel, I don't know how to write a letter like this one. This is the first letter I have written to anyone. I told you I am sick, and that is true. But there is another sickness, and that is all the other secrets that lie hidden. One of these secrets you asked me to keep, and others I had to keep. But most of them originate from this fact. The first time you remember meeting me is not the first time we met. You didn't come here from the river. You didn't come from the north. You came from inside the company. I found you because you'd come from the company. Your parents died soon after you came here. They died in a terrible way, and it left such a mark on you. I found you staggering near the holding ponds at the company building on a day 7 years ago, a few months before your memory of meeting me. You were distraught, far gone in your grief, and you hadn't eaten in days. The holding ponds were a horror show back then, much worse than now. A cynical place that allowed the company to think of itself as merciful because so much of what it dumped still lived for a time. This abandonment of experiments occurred at a terrifying pace, and the feeding frenzy of scavengers and animals was murderous. When I found you, you were walking through scenes of slaughter and desperation, a hell on earth of company discards. I don't know how long you would have survived there. How long before someone decided you were biotech, not human at all, and butchered you or captured you or took you and tried to modify you? You were in shock. Your eyes didn't focus. Your clothing was torn and someone had already taken your shoes off of you. You said something to me when I came up to you as if whatever you were thinking you just said. But flat, disengaged, as if you came from another planet. You're beautiful, so beautiful. And someone beautiful wouldn't hurt me. It was nothing like what I thought you would say, nothing like the person you are now, either. And it was the only thing you said for quite some time. I laughed when you said it. It was nonsense. It confirmed your dysfunction, your dislocation. It confirmed you as salvage. And it wasn't true. I did hurt you. Just not by leaving you there. And for a very long time, I had no idea why. I could not understand why I saved you. I told myself it was because you were the only thing human in that landscape, and I saw you so suddenly. Because I didn't expect you there. Because I didn't expect you to say that. Because in a way, I had been discarded too. But back at the balcony cliffs, you did not get better. You did not stop being damaged because of what had happened to you. Some people come into the city from inside the company, not from the outside. At least, they used to. Your parents had come from inside the company, stowaways, in crates, supplies being sent to the city from some other place. If I cannot tell you what that other place might be, it is because no one here in the city knows, and most do not guess at its existence. But if you came in a supply crate, you weren't human by company rules. Instead, you were parts or biotech. No exceptions. Just some small mercy that someone wouldn't kill you, a young woman, and they dumped you at the holding ponds instead to let you die out of their sight. But your parents died inside the company building. They were killed, coming out of the crates, murdered. And you had witnessed it, seen it all. And then been thrown out into a bloody wasteland at the edge of a city you did not know, that you had never seen before. You couldn't get your bearings. Your parents had brought you here so far from any sea, and then been killed in front of you. And it had broken something inside of you that you could not repair. And one day, just a month after I took you in, once you understood what I did, you sought me out and begged me to take your memories. You wanted your memories scattered to the four winds. You wanted them all gone, not buried or repressed or forgotten like a scar, but gone, every last bit. You wanted to start fresh. Fill me up with someone else's memories, you said. I know you care about me, Wick. Please do this for me. It was the first time I had seen any emotion in you. Because you wanted this, I knew you were out of your mind. But soon enough, I also knew if I didn't give you what you wanted, that you would find some other way, go to someone else for it, or worse. You continued to be confusing to me. I had left the company after the fish project, driven out, tossed to the holding ponds myself, where they expected me to die, like others before me. Instead, I made a life in the city. But I didn't consider myself a person. I didn't make decisions like a person. I felt, after all I had done and endured in the company, that I didn't deserve that. I felt instead that I was lost and would remain lost, and all I could expect was to survive. So I had made decisions like someone who wasn't a person, who just wanted to survive. Yet I made decisions about you that didn't make sense. I should never have taken you from the holding ponds, never been involved. I should have left you to your fate, whatever that might be. It bothered me that I went through these motions of being a person, of letting you into my life. Only now, I had to cut you from my life if I was to give you what you wanted. You would have no memory of me or anything in the city. For so many reasons, I told you I wouldn't do it. Still, you persisted, clung to this idea like it was the only thing that could save you. And I think you were wanting to punish yourself. I think you believed you deserved punishment for being powerless. But you were also traumatized and hurt and lonely and confused. To have gone from the life you were living with your parents to being without them and in this place. So eventually, I did what you asked, or most of it. I took your memories of the city, your parents' death, the time right before. I took all of that away, but I left everything else. I don't know if it will be harder for you, the Rachel now, to understand why you asked for that obliteration or to understand why I couldn't give you everything you asked for. You hadn't asked me to kill you. You had asked, instead, to become a different person, to be allowed to create a different life from the ground up. And if I respected you, surely if I loved you, I should have done as you asked. But the idea of making you less than a person, a cipher, was not possible for me. You could not know that, but it was the thing least possible for me. Nor could I imagine, except as atrocity, filling you back up with someone else's memories without your knowledge. So I told myself I would make it up to you. I would find a way. But really, what I found was a selfishness. A way to still know you even though you no longer knew me. After, I set you loose again, to be on your own again. Because what did I know about living with a person, being with a person, taking care of a person? Nothing. When you woke, I had made sure it would be near the poisoned river, beneath the balcony cliffs, so I could watch you through my binoculars, make sure you regained consciousness and were still safe. I watched you get up. I watched you walk away. And I thought that was it. That was the end of it. But I kept thinking about you, what you were doing, if you felt better now. If what I had done was a good thing or a bad thing, or neither. I could not help myself. I started to seek you in the city. And when I finally found you, for a time, I just observed, thought that might be enough. But then, one day, the meeting you remember, back down by the river, where I sought you out and I lied to you. I pretended I didn't know you, offered you what I could offer. I asked if you wanted memories of a better time. I could provide those. It's what I did. You said no. If you had said yes, I had resolved to do it, and then walk away and never seek you out again. In a way, you would have gotten what you wanted before. I could never tell you what I had done. I was too afraid, and then, eventually, too much time had passed. I was living in the center of a lie. Even if, before, we had known each other such a short time, I felt ashamed of using what I knew of you to my advantage. Despite a terrible, unworthy elation beneath, that second chance, that moment when you had stayed, and then we were partners, fortifying the balcony cliffs, living there. The Rachel without the company, without her parents' death, was confused, yes, sad, yes. But you were also more sure of yourself, and you had lost that desperation, that agitation to the eyes that had told me of some deep wound. I began to wonder if I might be capable of being a person after all, there at the moment of my greatest betrayal. That is the most ironic thing, that I thought betraying you was a form of being trustworthy, as if the world were upside down. But that is not the only thing I had done. Before we met again, before you began living again at the balcony cliffs, there was something else I never told you. You wanted oblivion. You wanted not to exist. But there was a price for that. I sold your memories to the magician. That was my price, the price you agreed to without knowing. The memories from inside the company, the memories of me, of your parents' death, how you had gotten to the access point. The magician had taken an interest in me, as she did in all creatures of the company, especially people she had known in the company, people she thought knew more than she did about the company. She asked questions. She infiltrated. She discovered the survival of the fish project because I went to the holding ponds and she saw me there. She used that information to figure out even more. You must understand, I did not really care about you when I first saw you. I did not care about you except as salvage. I did not care about anyone. Caring came later. And I didn't see the harm. I didn't think I would ever see you again. I thought the magician would fade, that she would be one of those who got killed or was never heard from again. Nothing at that time except a certain ruthlessness, a coldness around the eyes, could have told anyone she would rise so far, not given her opposition to the company. But the magician knew about Mord from her other sources, and she was already using that to blackmail me, to extract. I gave her what I thought compromised me least, and in return, she stayed silent and sold me the supplies I needed. Because it's true what she found out. I helped create Mord. The company used what we had learned from the Fish Project to build Mord. But the company wasn't building him from scratch. Not putting a human face on an animal, as happened with the fish. No. They wanted to create an animal around a human being. Maybe I didn't realize what the company planned to do to him, but that is no excuse. I should have found a way out, or found a way to get Mord out. Except there was no choice, not really. I was the one who did that as the Fish Project wound down. I made the transition for him when asked to. I held his hand as it began, before he no longer really recognized me. At the start, I don't think he understood what was going to happen. And then I was gone, discarded by the company, and I could do nothing for Mord, not even comfort him. I could not even save the fish. All I could do was put it out of its misery, after it languished for a few months in the holding ponds. The only good thing it seemed that I'd done was salvaging you. I knew what you had really asked for, and what I had done, but I thought it would all go away, become nothing, not even history. But it didn't, it couldn't. It only lay submerged for a while. The magician had not just the knowledge of my role in creating Mord, but then when I brought you back into the balcony cliffs, that further knowledge of your history whenever she needed something. Until she asked for the balcony cliffs, and that was too much. Then came Bourne. And I couldn't take Bourne from you because I had meddled in your life too much already. You kept asking me if Bourne was a person, but I didn't believe I was a person, Rachel, so I couldn't tell you. Because what you will learn, Rachel, is that I am not what you think I am. I am more like Bourne. And every time you told me he was human, I felt less human, less real. And I don't blame you for that, but that's how it is for me, and always will be. You must understand that I have done nothing that was meant to hurt you. Everything I have done, for many years, has been for you and to keep the balcony cliffs safe. Please, I hope you will believe me. I had read Wick's letter while still in our temporary shelter. I struggled with it every moment of our journey into the company building. I struggled with it every time I propped Wick up, gave him water, goaded him forward. Every time I looked at Wick, I saw something different, felt something different. He was like a mirror and a window, and the scene kept changing. When I thought I could be reduced no further, when I thought nothing more could be taken from me, even what seemed to restore something to me, became a further reduction. What if I had wanted to be lost? What if my earlier self had been the smartest, the wisest, to want to remove all of that from me, so I could survive, so maybe I could be happy? What if my unhappiness had always been from having remembered happiness? We always have a choice. Even if the choice is amnesia or your own death. But now, too, I finally understood the extent of the weight on Wick, that this was a secret that could kill him in a different way than his sickness, something that would make many in the city hate him, even want to kill him, or, among the Mord worshippers, lift him up in a way that would kill him just as surely. Now I knew why Wick kept trying, forgave so much. Because he felt he had so much to be forgiven for. But in the end, what it came down to was this. I did not want to remember. I did not need to remember. No one was less dead or more alive after Wick's letter. Whatever muddle had lived in my head that Wick hadn't taken away contained at least that knowledge. I had spent years not searching for them, but mourning them, keeping their memory alive in my head. I did not want to remember more. You forgive if you can forgive yourself or live with what you've done. If you cannot live with what you have done, you cannot live with what others have done either. Wick's letter no longer exists. I destroyed it because it was dangerous, but I have not forgotten what he wrote. There are parts of that letter I will never share with you. The Way Back and What I Witnessed on the Horizon. The way back was no easier than the way there. The way back was harder, and no getting around that. No truth I learned struggling back, except that life is struggle. It placed me in some gray realm beyond. A landscape of exertion and anguish. I had nothing left to give, and yet still, I had something left to give. The little animals did not help. Their purposes were so different from my own. They did not care that Wick was ill or that I was so very tired. They nosed around the magician's dead body and licked her hands and her face. and then left her alone and went on with their business. Perhaps she rotted away there, underground. An attrition of steps I took with Wick, or could not take, in the moment, but had to take soon or the will would be gone. The worst thing was that I could not escape any of the passing seconds. Every moment came to me clear and distinct, and no one moment stood for anything but itself. I felt time ache in my body, in my need to get Wick back to some kind of temporary shelter, to fling myself free of the wreckage. I was thinking about my parents, of all the long forced marches we had taken, how they'd helped me to endure, and how they'd been brave enough to get me here, and how I couldn't fail. At a certain point, I could again hear the distant sound of conflict, and although still trapped in the company building, I knew this meant the battle still raged between Mord and Bourne. But when you can't escape the seconds, when you are sure you are going to die before you get free, some things don't mean very much anymore. The sounds I heard came to me through a murky sea of distance and memory. I brought Wick back through the debris of the company, up through that artificial tornado of junk, and sliding, torn skin and bruises being the best of me, back through the crack passage, and even through the choked relief and gasp of our collapse onto the blood sands of the holding ponds, caressed by those shallow, dangerous waters, shambling our way into the light we thought might kill us, only to discover the guards had left their posts, the proxies gone, and on the horizon the mirage for which we had no conception, no compass. Two great beasts fought amid the burning wreckage of a city, smashed into each other, withdrew, engaged again, exhausted, exhausting the brutality. Gray smoke drawn up into the sky to linger around the vultures gliding high above the behemoth's heads like ragged black halos. Wick had had a relapse in the narrow space of the tunnel, would have fallen, become wedged there, unconscious and barely responsive, if I had not been vigilant, to prop him up, to push him forward, to hold his head when he vomited. The venom had worked deeper into him. His veins stood out black on the surface of his reddish skin, his lips stained black, his breaths shallow and foul. His eyes remained closed, but fluttered. I could feel his eyelids flutter against my fingertips in the darkness, and that is how I knew. At the holding ponds, I gathered the last of my resolve and, staggering, carried Wick toward the desolate plain that was our reward for surviving this far, toward a city torn apart by monsters. There was nothing on that plain, or maybe there was, but the sight of Mord, doubled, had startled them into hiding. We would have been easy prey, and yet, mercifully, nothing approached us. I had taken the magician's camouflage biotech, but could not bring myself to wear what was clearly in distress. Placed it gently in the top of my pack before zipping it up. Maybe dangers lurked and waited, but I could not see them. "You're too valuable as salvage to leave behind," I told Wick. "You're doing fine. You're getting better," I said to Wick. "You just need to hang on a little longer," I pleaded with Wick. "So light, that body. So pliable, almost collapsible. As if the company had made him that way. And so weak that I was stronger than him. Stronger than I thought. His hands still able to grasp at me, involuntary, instinctual. "We'll rebuild the balcony cliffs," I told him, though he could not hear me. "We'll live there again." I did not say that thing just to comfort him, but to comfort me. I meant it, but only if it was both of us. If it was just me, I would melt into the city. I would disappear and give up my name and my past and any hope of a home and become no one. At the edge of the plain, the dark, dead forest waiting on the slope, I laid my burden gently on the ground amongst the sparse grass and dropped my pack. Wick's mouth was closed, his eyes were still closed, and he was cold. A terrible sense of drowning closed over me. Had he died as I carried him? Was he dead now? I could not tell if he had a pulse. With my broken fingers, my hands that shook. There was a resting peace to his features I did not want to interpret. But he could not be dead. I would not let him be dead. I put water to his lips, then mine. I kissed his filthy face and bathed it. I said his name again and again and again. I paid no mind to anything but his slack, small body there in the yellowing grass. I could not even shake him or in any other way try to bring him back because I was sure the slightest tremor would do him damage. I knelt there beside Wick, feeling so very light and so very helpless. I was covered in dirt, in blood both mine and not mine. My stomach was a shriveled pebble in my belly, my body so dry I had no tears. I calmed myself. I stopped the shaking by holding my right arm in a vise with my left hand and taking Wick's wrist with my right hand, long enough to convince myself I felt a faint pulse of life there, that he would hold on if I just kept going, if I didn't give up on him. I put my pack back on. I gathered Wick up, I got my legs underneath me, widened my stance, and lifted him. Together, Wick and I started up the slope. There comes a moment when you witness events so epic, you don't know how to place them in the cosmos or in relation to the normal workings of a day. Worse, when these events recur at an ever greater magnitude, in a cascade of what you have never seen before and do not know how to classify. Troubling because each time you acclimate, you move on, and if this continues, there is a mundane grandeur to the scale that renders certain events beyond rebuke or judgment, horror or wonder, or even the grasp of history. As I carried Wick up the slope, there came a sound from the city, a new sound. It was like the reverse of the sound that had left us when Mord lost the power to fly. A snap that kept snapping, as if it had moved through the ground, like an earthquake, but not. A sound that made you look up. Still far off, but clear above the trees, in the late morning light, Mord no longer fought Mord. Instead, Mord fought Born. For Born had shed his disguise, had abandoned claws and fangs to become even more terrible and complete. Like a true god, one who repudiated worship because he had been raised by a scavenger who had never learned religion. The monster I had helped raise, fighting the monster Wick had helped create. Such a shock to see the fur instantly replaced with the Born I knew, but much, much larger. A glowing purple vase shape, a silhouette rising that could have been some strange new building, but was instead a living creature. Born was failing as Mord, so now he would try his luck as himself. He rose and rose to a full height, a little taller than Mord, the familiar tentacles shooting out, while below, at his base, I knew that he was anchored by cilia, now each grown as large as me. Mord stumbled back, smashing walls of already crumbling buildings, great clouds of dust rising from his surprise, but only for a moment, and when the gouts and storms of dust had settled, I could see that Mord had surged forward to attack newly vulnerable flesh, while the proxies no doubt swarmed Born's base. There came from Mord's throat a chuffing roar of purest joy, as if blissful to no longer be fighting himself, to engage with a creature clarified and robbed of disguise. For the cost to Born was monumental. No matter how he altered himself, bristling with spikes and ridges, no matter how he battered Mord with tentacles that Mord tore off only for them to return. He could not stop the truest killer of the two, could not stop Mord from ripping into his flesh. Mord dug into Born, tore off great curving slices, which shivered and quaked as they fell, and as Born screamed, a sound so piercing it buckled my knees on the hillside, and I felt a deep fear, a rending, thinking of what should happen if Mord won, if Born died. Mord leapt again and again, brought Born close, paws forcing the neck of Born down as Born strobed, as rings of eyes appeared and then disappeared in his distress. Born shook and flailed, pried at Mord with his tentacles, but Mord held on, trying to deliver a death bite, ravaged Born's throat and tore into him with his claws. Those fangs snapped through Born with a terrible wrenching and crunching that laid my heart bare. The Mord proxies were dark smudges clambering up Born's sides while Mord artfully runneled Born's flesh as if it were wax and Mord's claws were made of flame. More of Born came away, smashing wetly to the distant ground. Born now flailed in that embrace, being broken down in a way I had not known was possible, in a vision becoming so horrific I kept looking away as I stumbled forward with Wick. But it was no use evading. As Born's life ebbed, I could feel his wounds through the gravity of my own. Until Born gave up. Until Born understood, I believe, just what he had to do. He would not win. He could not win. Weapon he might be, but Born was not, in the end, hardened as Mord was hardened. Mord would keep devouring, would keep seeking the snap, the gurgle, the spray of blood that ended his prey. Never retreat, never surrender, as if that meant death. What happened next, no one in the city could see all of, but all of us could see part of. Yet in memory, it is complete. As Mord feasted on Born's flesh, Born changed tactics. Instead of trying to become taller, he spread out, giving away his height so that Mord was angled into Born, tunneling through flesh, sloppy with it, seeking the heart of Born, that he might tear it out and hold it up, still beating for the city to see. But Born kept flattening and widening the aperture at the top of his body until he resembled an enormous passion flower blossom, complex and beautiful, with many levels. To Mord, it must have resembled surrender, as if Born was dying and that is why the end came so quick, abrupt. Mord rose up, straight up, higher and higher on his hind legs, and then came down, straight down into Born. But Born was still opening up and opening up, and so Mord fell straight into Born and kept falling and falling while the sides of Born now rose, shot up with an elated speed, and tentacles formed over the top of Mord like bars. Born lunged toward the sky, closed like a trap, with the head of Mord still visible at the aperture. There came a muffled whimpering and screaming, a howling, a roaring, a blustering, a snapping of mighty jaws. Mord punched out from his prison, still ripping through flesh, struggling to get free. The air seemed to be sucked away, out of the sky, toward Born. Sound left us. There came a blinding, silver-white light, a radiance that seared out across the landscape in a wave and threw me to the ground, Wick beneath me, a wave of light that emitted no heat, a thunderclap, very close, very loud, a word in my head, I swear, a word, just my name, Rachel, which meant something different than it had meant a moment before. I lay there for a long moment, unsure of what I would see when I rose. I got up. I looked back across the city. No bodies lay broken and giant across that landscape. No remains. No carcasses for scavengers to feed on. Both Mord and Born were gone, as if they had not existed, and the city was still and silent but for the grieving of the proxies and the sinuous smoke that still rose from all that had been destroyed. But there was no space left in me. I was filled with the grief of that absence, could hardly breathe for it. He was Born, but I had borne him. I knew Born was terrified at the end. I knew that he had suffered, but that he had given us this gift of a better life anyway. And I mourned the child I had known, who was kind and sweet and curious, and yet could not stop killing. What happened after, and what changed? There is not much left to tell. So much of the rest is aftermath, the life I lead now. At the cistern, our temporary shelter, I fed Wick as if he were a rare and fragile hummingbird. As the last of the venom worked its way through his system, I made him drink the water from the well. I dressed his wounds and cleaned them. I talked to him, even though he still could not hear me. I held his hand. I kept watch for any enemy, but no enemy came. As I worked, I told him I loved him, that he was a person, that he was a person, that I loved him, because I meant it, because I thought if he didn't hear it, he might die, and later I might not be able to say it. We were always finding each other and losing each other and finding each other again, and that was just the way of us. I don't know how else to say it. Perhaps only I could truly make Wick a person by forgiving him. And if I forgave him, if I showed I forgave him, then maybe we could be people together. Outside, it rained for 3 days and nights. That would have been strange by itself, an event. But this was no ordinary rain. All manner of creature dropped from the sky, or, at the touch of this rain, sprouted up from the ground. Grass grew fast and wild outside the cistern, created paths of green, and on some of the dead blackened trees down the slopes, I noticed new leaves. There were, on certain avenues in the city, I would learn, new growths of vines and plants that had been gone for years. Birdsong came lyrical through the storms, and animals long hidden emerged from sanctuary. But most of it was biotech, uncanny. On the desolate plain, the water triggered the last of the traps, and up came vast clouds and explosions of life, even eruptions of bees, or things that looked like bees, out of the marsh, taken up by the wind and scattered. Elongated, elastic creatures dug themselves out from long slumber and, suspicious and almost in their stride apologetic, walked bandy-legged away to dig burrows. At the holding ponds, the waters swelled and overflowed, and all that lay there flooded the company building, spilled out across the plain, and even now we do not know how much of the new life among us comes from that moment. In the city itself, torrents of alcohol minnows came to slippery, wriggling life, joined by microorganisms in the rain to populate broken streets and infiltrate cracks and grottos. There came from across the city, to the astonishment of people used to poverty, such a sense in that moment of plenty. On the third day, the torrent ended, and the moisture evaporated or disappeared into the ground, and much of the greenery receded, and the new animals died, or hid, or were eaten. To an observer fresh to the city, it might have looked as broken and useless as before. But it was not. Some new things remained, took root, became permanent. Some flourished. The city had been washed as clean as it could be, and what had been taken away was as important as what had been added. On the fourth day, Wick's eyes opened, and they were clear and clean of pain, and he tottered to his feet, looked around the cistern with a weak smile on his face. I had kept Wick alive. I had failed at so much else, but I kept Wick alive. He gave me our last password in those first lucid moments, the word that told me he was real. "We don't need them anymore," I told him. A confusion spread across his face until he understood. A lesser person than Wick would have surrounded himself with a fake past, with a personal history, constructed some pretense, handed out lies, or leaned on whatever fake memories the company had given him. But Wick had not done that. Wick had kept himself apart, had preferred to be alone, to be lonely, rather than to be held captive.
"You saved my life," Wick said, and kissed me.
And I let him. That night, we returned home to the balcony cliffs to sift through the wreckage and to begin again. The strange forgotten animals abandoned by the company live among us, along with their insatiable curiosity. Like borns that want nothing from the old world, they need nothing from it. They are their own captains and lead their own lives, although there are still human beings who see them as food, as expendable. In their fearlessness, I find a kind of solace. In how they pursue their own plans, their own destiny, I find relief. They will outstrip all of us in time, and the story of the city will soon be their story, not ours. The moored proxies were still a terror for a time, but they had their own terror to face, that their master was dead. Many died within 3 or 4 years, and those left were both more dangerous and more civilized. They had their own intricate, chirping, huffing language, and have begun to develop their own customs. The cubs are far removed already from unthinking violence and act more like bears, wary and clever, and more cautious, as if they understand better their place. The feral children, the ones the magician created, dissolved into the city. Some were too damaged, and these formed their own outlaw communities, entrenched deep below the factories, and at night the remnants come out to terrorize, to remind us they still exist. But they too are much reduced, and they can never again hold territory, as they did under the magician. Others found their own way out. Some could return to families and be forgiven and taken in, despite their physical deformity, despite their psychosis. Others had no such recourse but gave up their old ways and lived in the shadows under bridges and in abandoned buildings. They would never be entirely whole again, and there was nothing anyone could do to remedy that. But I can stroll down an avenue lined with young trees now, visit a market where people under shelter of makeshift tents barter for goods. I can do that, even if there are still parts of the city I could never visit because too much violence lurks there. At times, in the observatory district, we see regular lights, and some are electric, a part of the old world brought back to us. Wells dug or cleaned out, filtered, and communities growing up around them. The planting of vegetables, the rumors of an orchard or two. There are fewer dead astronauts at the intersections to confuse us. There is only us now, and the monsters, who are both part of history and always with us. In this new old city, I want no great power, no power at all, only power over my own life. All I wanted is for there to be no great power in the city at all, no company, no morgue, no magician. And in the end, although I loved him, no born. For a time, I saw the little fox outside the balcony cliffs. For a time, the fox followed me, the bright eyes,
the alert ears, the quick gait. "Did you pick me?" I would ask her. "Did you mean for me to find Bourne? Or was it an accident, a mistake, chance? And did you know what might happen when I found him?" I never expected an answer. And eventually, the fox did not return. Wick tells me we live in an alternate reality. But I tell him the company is the alternate reality, was always the alternate reality. The real reality is something we create every moment of every day, that realities spin off from our decisions in every second we're alive. I tell him the company is the past preying on the future, that we are the future. A glittering reef of stars spread out phosphorescent, and each one might have life on it, planets revolving around them. There might even be people like us looking up at the night sky. Was there a world beyond? Is that what the shining wall of silver raindrops meant, a gateway? Or is that a delusion? It doesn't matter, because now we can make one here, a world. How I live now. The balcony cliffs lay empty when we returned. We came in cautious, prepared to drive intruders out, but the bears had left and everyone else had been too scared to move in. The moored proxies had destroyed so much, but what set us falling to the floor laughing was that at first we could not tell the parts they had destroyed from the parts they had left alone, except by the sign of their droppings. So many holes punched in walls by Bourne. Seeing the balcony cliffs with fresh eyes, we realized we had lived in a tidied-up shithole that needed a more thorough airing than we had ever given it. "What now, Rachel?" Wick asked me. "What do we do now?" "Whatever we want to do," I said. So we set to work. Wick has never been the same physically, although he has some good days. The left side of his body has seized up, and his left arm doesn't work right. His skin never became pale again, but is crisscrossed with black vein lines. He sometimes has a distant look, as if listening to music I cannot hear. But most of the time, he is not lost in fugue or memory, or wherever he goes during those episodes. We live. We stand by each other and make do with what we have. He fixed his swimming pool, still makes biotech, found ways to create his medicine before reaching the fourth month and the last Nautilus pill. I never told Wick I killed the magician. She just never came back. If Wick could carry the heavy burden of his secret for so long, then I could hold on to mine and not burden him with it. Nor did I tell Wick that I knew his secret, his final secret. We never talked about his letter, although he must know that I read it. To be together, Wick and I needed some secrets from each other and some things we could not talk about. The talking was the trap. The things we say to each other, thinking they are so important to say, and yet later regret, that become a part of you no matter how hard you push them away, even as you can't stop thinking about them. I prefer the old betrayals, the ones based on trust. My presence beside him tells him all he needs to know, and no matter what else he has done in his life, Wick has never killed anyone with a rock. Nor does Wick sell memories anymore. Wick never believed he was a person, was continually being undone by that. Bourne was always trying to be a person because I wanted him to be one, because he thought that was right. We all just want to be people, and none of us know what that really means. Early on, I had thought Wick was reaching for a body across the bed, but for a long time, he had been reaching for me, for the person called Rachel, who did indeed, in the end, love back the person named Wick. Life is still hard, but it is fair. And there is more joy in it that doesn't feast on heartbreak. There are also territories not worth holding on to, traps not worth setting. Other people live at the balcony cliffs with us now. Other faces stare at me when I walk these corridors. Most of them we invited in, and many are children with no place to go. We do not ask anything of them except that they scavenge what they can and help maintain the balcony cliffs. Wick creates things for the children, bits of biotech from odds and ends that make them laugh or astonish them. I like to watch Wick at play. I like to hear the children laugh. It is so much better than a fancy restaurant. It is more like the botanical garden on the island. It is almost like that. Teams is one of the boys here, and the closest to being my child. I had the fantasy of finding the girl, the leader, and raising her as my own, but I never found her. Instead, I found Teams, and I took him in. He was the first. Teams is just an ordinary boy who likes playing catch and hates vegetables and reads my collection of books when I make him. Teams doesn't mind roughhousing in the mud, and the stubborn set to his jaw always makes him look as if he is objecting to something. But his eyes are large and wide, and they take in everything, do not miss the smallest detail. He is honest and respectful, and he has honor and courage as he is able. I teach him only the useful things, the hopeful things. I teach him to be both the things I am and the things I can never be. I am sure Teams thinks of me, of Wick, as old, as people who are too generous and not hardened enough, people who can no longer see the traps. But did we ever really see them? And we have had our adventures, Wick and I. We have had all the adventures one lifetime could endure, and it is fine that no one knows but us. That Wick and I hold on to those secrets together. There is so little of this account that anyone else in the city would understand or believe, and so little of it they need to understand. I have only one thing left to tell. How, on a sunny gunmetal day, not long after we returned to the balcony cliffs, I went searching, as any scavenger would, near the place in the city where Bourne and Mord had disappeared. There, I found Bourne again. I picked him out of the rubble. I brushed him off. He was weak, tiny, as small as the first time I found him. But it was him. He smelled like the ocean of my youth, the sea salt and the surf and the seaweed. But he might have smelled different to someone else. I gathered Bourne up as good salvage, and I took him back to the balcony cliffs. He did not speak, could not speak, but I felt as if he were still there, inside. He had killed so many people. He had done terrible things despite not wanting to do them. We had all done terrible things. I put him on our balcony, right where Wick could see him, and promised myself that if Bourne ever grew, if he ever spoke, I would end him. That if Wick wanted to take him, Wick should take him and use him for parts. But none of those things happened. Wick did not take him. Bourne did not move on his own. He was just a kind of plant, taking sustenance from the sun. Bourne never spoke again. Although I spoke to him, and maybe I wished he could respond, but only a little. A lingering doubt, a lingering need, and I think you can forgive me that, at least. We sit on the balcony on the good days, Wick and I, and we hold hands and look out at the light on the river at dusk. To those who know me so many years later, I am just a middle-aged woman who lives in the balcony cliffs and takes care of children. A person who they see sometimes, high above a river that is not as polluted as before. A river that one day may be truly beautiful.
This concludes the reading of Born by Jeff Vandermeer. Copyright 2017 by Vandermeer Creative Incorporated. This book was read by Bonnie Turpin. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Ferrer, Strauss & Giroux, LLC, and was produced in 2017 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.